beep, doo doo doo, wah wah, doodaloo. What's up, Jake?
What?
I don't know. Maybe it's relevant to a question we're going to talk about later.
Okay.
Maybe I'm setting us up.
I have read the questions. I'm still confused, but okay.
Yeah, let's get weird right out of the gate.
Yeah, yeah.
How you doing, man?
I like it. I'm okay. I'm full from dinner, but other than that, I'm good.
What'd you have?
Quesadillas.
Well, that's what you're full. You shouldn't have had a whole case.
Well, enjoy doing the rest of the mailbag by yourself, Blake, because I quit.
Oh boy. Oh, Cassie chime in. What did she say?
I don't know. She yelled something because she didn't realize we were recording yet. What'd you say? She's apologizing and now can't stop laughing. So I think we're getting a straight answer out of her. Now she's turning so red. Oh, she's
and
so embarrassed.
That was the end of your July mailbag episode.
So embarrassing. Oh my God.
All right, Jake, we're going to get to the mailbag once in your life, maybe tonight. You've got some questions for us.
She woke from a dream. Her head was on fire. Why was he so nervous? He took her to the park. She crossed her arms and lowered her eyelids. Someday somebody's gonna ask you a question that you should say yes to once in your life. Maybe tonight I got a question for you. I got a question for you.
I gotta say, I am impressed and thrilled that you threw in an old 97 song without me having to ask.
Yeah.
Which is a good one.
Why not?
One day we'll do an old 97s episode and I'll be happy. Yeah.
My long list of in notes in my phone of songs that I think of that have something about questions or answers in the lyrics so that I can use them in those places in the mailbag.
That's fair. We got to old 97s before Goldfinger. I'm shocked.
Yeah. But we've done Goldfinger in other ways is the thing.
That's
right?
True. That's true. Good point. Good point.
All right. Our first question today comes from Mike. He asks, inspired by Blake being a new dog daddy, what would be the first album, artist, song you show your future kids once they get into music? Just a slight correction here. I am not a new dog dad. I just foster. Russ is with us still because this infection in his foot won't go away. But yes, I'm not technically a new dog dad. I just foster. The first songs that I played for Russ were, of course, Judas by Fozzy, Metalingus by Alter Bridge, and Mary Mac by Great Big Sea. The three kind of catch up on what dad's like, you know. So two wrestling song, a song by a wrestler, a wrestling theme song, and Mary Mac by Great Big Sea. Jake, I think you have a more thoughtful answer for this question, which I'm going to chalk up to the fact that like you're engaged and have had to at some point ostensibly think about things like how you'd mess up your kids, whereas I just swoop in and make jokes about it.
On very literally our first date, we were both like, oh, we're not having kids. Absolutely not. Perfect. Which is great. But I realize now that my pick both works as a dad rock joke, but also as a real answer, which I didn't intend, but is true. I just went with the first music that I ever heard, which has put me on a path that you can argue is good or bad, depending on the day. But the first music that I was ever, actually, I think technically the first music I ever heard was Tommy by The Who, which I obviously didn't understand. Because it's kind of fucked up. But the first music that I remember, I loved Tommy as a kid, but the first music I remember connecting to as a very young lad would be the artist fondly known as The Boss. And that would be, of course, the dad of all dad rock, Bruce Springsteen.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me and I want you only. Don't turn me home again, I just can't face myself.
Jake, I got to be honest, huge upset here on the podcast that the co-host who is not the sports writer brought up Springsteen first.
Right? And I would say the co-host who's not a sports writer is the bigger Springsteen fan of the two.
I would absolutely say that's correct. That song, by the way, is called Thunder Road. To build off of you introducing that, Jake, I'm pretty sure the first music I heard was Bon Jovi. I have a young aunt, like my dad's youngest sibling, who spent a lot of time with us when I was a baby because like my parents weren't married yet and stuff like that. And she would babysit and she was like big into that like hair rock kind of stuff. So there are like definitely photos of me where you can almost guarantee that Bon Jovi is playing. But Meatloaf is the first like I remember, like I could remember knowing the words to a song or like appreciating a song via, you know, cassettes in my dad's minivan or whatever.
Yeah, cassettes in cars, definitely that age for music. I feel like my parents are a bit older, I think, than most people's my age. So like their music taste is very much like very classic rock. So like all the first music I heard was like Springsteen, Dylan, The Who, Rolling Stones, that kind of stuff. Which is not a bad thing, but it's just fact of the matter.
Yeah. All right. So that is Jake Jr. is going to be growing up on Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen. I appreciate this question. It's a good one. And we have a question later that I think we can better answer that's similar to this. But I think both of us are so far from the idea of having kids, it's a little harder to put ourselves in that.
Very fair.
In that spot. Question number two comes from Lauren. She asks, thoughts on cover songs? Like them or kitschy? Best ones you've seen done live? I saw Arcade Fire cover Wolf Parade and Frank Turner cover Neil Young. Those are hers. Those are two pretty big ones. Pretty good ones.
Yeah. I'm a cover song supporter to an extent. I think they're great in concerts, like especially if it's sort of like a fun cover and the band's not taking the cover seriously. Like just like this is a fun addition to our set. I also don't mind them on records as long as it's different than the original. Like I've heard some covers that are basically like note for note retread of the original record, and I don't love that. But, you know, I do love me some Ska Tune Network and his emo goes ska or ska goes emo, whatever it's called, series is wonderful. I obviously love Me First and the Gimme Gimmes.
Yeah, this was my big note for this one is like, however I feel about covers, like song to song, I will always go to bat for those like Punk Goes Pop and Punk Goes Trunk records.
Absolutely.
Those were great.
Absolutely. And I'm a big fan of bands that throw covers in sort of like interpolated through their own songs. Like Dismemberment Plan would always close their shows with a song from their first record called OK Joke's Over, which has a really long like bass breakdown. And they would put in whatever pop song was on their mind that day in the middle. And it would just be Travis Morrison kind of screaming it along to the tune of their song, which I always appreciated. Oh, I thought was fun.
That's fun. I've mentioned on this pod before, I've seen Bare Naked Ladies live twice when I was younger, and they did something similar where part of their encore was they would do like a medley of basically whatever the top 10 most popular, like think of the Weird Al medleys that were on every album. Bare Naked Ladies just did one of those, their own take, and they just mixed all the songs together, which was cool. I like covers in general. I think it's fun to hear bands kind of reimagine songs that they didn't write, and it's kind of a cool way, like when you see what a band covers, you know, it's a cool way to follow the thread of what they like and why they like it, and you know, then their spin on the sound. I will say, in terms of favorite ones I've seen done live, Phoebe Bridgers doing Sheryl Crow's If It Makes You Happy at Velvet Underground was very, very good. Michael Sarah Palin also have a really good cover of If It Makes You Happy. I think that song is just a really good song to cover.
Yeah, I have weirdly seen two different acts cover A Taste of You by Joni Mitchell. We saw Gang of Youths do it. And then when Cass and I went to see James Blake last year, he also did it. I don't know if it's like we're in Canada, so we have to cover Joni Mitchell response.
Hey, that's good pandering. If you're pandering with Joni Mitchell or Neil Young, you're pandering up the right alley, you know?
Yeah. I also went to a Tyus Andronicus show once, and Patrick Stickles told everyone to stop moshing and crowd surfing, and a bunch of people didn't. So he just played like three really angry Neil Young covers and ended the show. That made me laugh.
All right. Question number three comes from Phil. He says, on the same topic, if you could hear one band do a full album of covers of another band, which bands would you choose? This is inspired by Thou's excellent Nirvana cover album. I actually thought, Jake, when we did the Nirvana episode, when you brought up Courtney Barnett as like a potential Cobain stand-in, like that's been stuck in my head, and I would like to hear more of that. Not to like stick with Nirvana as the answer, since it was the impetus for the question, but that's a cool one.
I think that is a cool one too, because like, but I feel like that one is just like a good fit. Like I want to hear, I'm not sure I want an album of that, but I definitely want a tour of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's the thing is like, I don't know if I go as far as album, but like a couple of the other ideas I came up with were like, I would love for one of the kind of indie folk singers that I like now to do a Breeders cover, like whether, you know, it's a poppier Hayley Williams version or like Soccer Mommy doing a Breeders cover or something like that. I also to kind of stick with the Paramore, like because I know Eva Hendrix is such a big fan, like I want Charlie Bliss to do a Paramore cover.
That would be cool. I feel like I like it more rather than like an existing band. I like it when sort of like a super group forms for it. Like I North by Northeast a couple years back, Bri Webb and I forget who else was in the band, but Bri Webb and three guys did a Replacements cover band for a night. And it was like kind of a Dwayne Gretzky kind of thing, but just Replacement songs. And like, I would listen to an album of that.
Yeah, don't the Constantines, the guys from Constantines also have a Neil Young cover group?
I think that one is like a bunch of Canadian band people. I think it's like a couple guys from the Cons. I want to say a couple guys from the Stills. I think that's that Tommy Youngstein thing, but I could be wrong.
Okay. The other answer here, of course, is now that Taylor Swift and Phoebe Bridgers have tweeted about their album covers being like sister album covers from like a goth Disney thing or something like that, I would love like Phoebe and Taylor Swift doing each other's songs on the same EP.
That would be cool. Yeah, I miss those old like the old split albums that like punk bands did in the early 2000s where it would be like two new songs and they'd each cover one of each other's songs.
Our next question comes from Chucks Ahoy, which makes me, I know it's not Chunks Ahoy, but I would love a cookie right now. I've been eating healthy and I want a cookie. So thanks, Chucks Ahoy. Is there one defunct band that you love dearly, but also hope never reunites? I like that you go deep in thought, even though you've already given me your answer.
Well, mine was the musical cue, so I didn't know what order to do it in. I was acting.
Yes, you can throw it out there whenever. I appreciate the drama that you're creating.
I was just trying to adhere to your run sheet, Blake.
Yes. Actors. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
No, my answer is a band that I kind of don't think will ever reunite. And that is, of course, Fugazi. And the reason I hope they don't ever reunite is because it's very easy, and I think cliche, and definitely something I was guilty of when I was a much younger man, of sort of the hero worship and like wondering what musicians are genuine and what they say. And not that Fugazi coming back would automatically make them, you know, anything against what they were, but for a band that was all about, you know, being genuine and anti-marketing, anti-capitalist, all that good stuff, I feel like, and I'm sure if they came back, they would do a tour that stuck to those views. I just don't know how possible that is in 2020, just based on the way the music industry exists. Like, I don't know if you can do, if like you can do a Fugazi reunion tour and charge $10. Like, I would hate to see them come back because people want it. People really want it. But then just the financials and the realities of 2020 mean that they'd have to charge more. And then they'd have to have the whole sellout conversation, which is a stupid conversation. And I don't know. I think Fugazi's place and their legacy is so secure and perfect as it is that I think I just want them to stay exactly where they left off. And where they left off began with this song.
Kind of like a Spin Doctors open to that one.
Don't you dare.
I'm just trying to make you dislike the song. That song is called Cash Out, by the way. Jake, so my answer here is a little difficult. I'm going to be an asshole about it. Sorry, Chuck Savoy. But given the track record of every group we talk about on this podcast reuniting, I don't actually think I can answer this because the nature of the question is that we don't want them to reunite, but simply by mentioning them on the podcast, you can't really, if I say a band's name, they will then reunite. This is Schrodinger's mailbag question. We can't do it.
It's true. We are guilty of this quite a few times. It seems.
To actually answer the question, I tend to feel the longer a band is done, the more I lean toward them staying broken up. And I know that that kind of goes against the like, hey, it's a nostalgia reunion tour 20 years later, or whatever. But the example I keep in mind is like Modern Baseball were one of my favorite bands. And if they reunited right now, I would probably be excited about it. But they are pushing up on an amount of time where I think I would just like be worried that they couldn't meet the expectation I'd have for it. And maybe that's like a U-shaped curve and it would round out again where like, you know, then they're a bad example 20 years down the line because I just don't think they have, you know, a deep enough catalog to resonate like that. But I do think for some bands in general, you know, you reunite quick and reframe it as a hiatus or you wait a really long time. Like the medium term comeback is just not, I feel like expectations versus what it'll actually be are too complicated. Now, to give an actual answer, it's basically any early 2000s pop punk band that didn't make it past like 2005 or 2006. I wouldn't want them to come back because a lot of them would probably be bad now.
Yeah,
not I think to keep bringing up like the starting line and Cartel in every podcast, but
that's always the fear, right? Like,
yeah,
I feel like most bands that do the comeback are good enough and have enough faith in their abilities to come back and not suck, but there's always the chance, right?
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, that gets into a little bit of why did they break up? What else is going on? Whereas, you know, not just that they didn't make it and now they're going to try again kind of thing.
Yeah.
All right. Our next question comes from Phil. Phil asks, what is your favorite opening line on an album, Jake?
So I was thinking about this question and I feel like there are sort of, I don't know. It's hard for me to separate the bands who I just really admire, the lyricists. And it's just like, oh, that's a great line from like what works best as an opener. But the three that came to my mind, which mostly stick to the former, one is from You Are Your Memory, which is the first track on the Mountain Goats album, The Sunset Tree, which is, I checked into a bargain price room on La Cienega, gazed out through the curtains at the parking lot, walked down to the corner store just before nightfall in my bare feet, black tarry asphalt, soft and hot. I just think it's such a good like opening phrase. Similarly, from Where the Devil Don't Stay by Drive-By Truckers, my daddy played poker on a stump in the woods back in his younger days. Prohibition was the talk, but the rich folks walked to the woods where my daddy stayed, which is when you have it in that Mike Cooley drawl, really, really works. And then I also have In Medias Res, the first track off of Romance is Boring by Los Campesinos, which
Hell
is,
yeah.
But let's talk about you for a minute with the vomit at your gullet from a half bottle of vodka that we'd stolen from the optic, which is just such a Los Campesinos lyric. All three of those guys are three of my favorite lyricists ever. And when they hit on an opening line, they really hit on an opening line.
All right. My answer to this one, you know, I gave this one a lot of thought and I actually have five written down to overdo it a little bit here. But the way that I open these podcasts, this has become a very important thing to me.
Fair.
With that in mind, a very recent one that I really appreciate is from In Utero. Teenage angst has paid off well. That's just a great start and much appreciated for this podcast.
Now we're born old.
Yeah, I think the classic one for me that like, you know, fits the brand and the genre is from Tell All Your Friends. So sick of being tired. Oh, so tired of being sick. So obviously desperate. So desperately obvious. That's a good one. I don't know if anyone who listens to this podcast have heard of a band called Pup, who have an album that starts, I was bored as fuck, sitting around thinking all this morbid stuff. Like if anyone I'd slept with is dead. Pretty good one there. And then to take it back a little bit, Patti Smith opens Horses with Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
Yep.
Which is a pretty great line. And then this one came up in an earlier podcast as well. But I am an American aquarium drinker. I assassin down the avenue to start Yankee Hotel Foxtrot is also a favorite of mine.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of my favorite.
I have a lot of answers, Jake. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I was gonna say a lot of my favorite opening lyrics in songs are Wilco lyrics, but not that many that other than that one that opened the records so much. Yeah. Also, close to home, Constructive Summer by The Hold Steady. Me and my friends are like the drums on Lust for Life, which is just a good one. Also, your Patti Smith one, a favorite quote of my father's.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. But yeah, I'm going to give the nod to so sick of being tired. Oh, so tired of being sick, you know?
Yeah, that's a good one.
We have not talked about Taking Back Sunday enough, so they are going to get the nod there. Our next question is semi-related to that. And Jake, you will now understand how this podcast opened. This question comes from Jay Nielsen.
Yes.
How do you feel about albums that start with an instrumental track? This podcast, I started with an instrumental track because my brain is turning to mush.
That's fair.
How do you feel about it, Jake?
I like it because it speaks to my theater kid nonsense. Like it feels like an overture.
Oh yeah, the lights down. You've been called to your seats.
Exactly.
Yeah, I feel what you're. The orchestra starts to swell, but no actors are on stage yet.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. I don't want to blow up one of your notes here, but I just agree.
But go for it.
I agree with one of your notes here, which is Broken Social Scene having instrumental intro and waiting 90 seconds into the second song to actually start is bullshit. I agree with that.
You get two opening instrumental tracks? What the hell?
No. If you're doing a instrumental opening, it should go right into the first song.
Right.
I kind of cheated with my song pick for this one because most of this album, not all of this album, but a lot of this album is instrumental. Because it was their first one and they were a lot more experimental. But my pick for my favorite opening instrumental track, which is off their very first record, their poster of a man on it is staring me in the face as I speak. This is Those Who Stayed by Murder by Death.
Gotta say that, you know, we talk about potential wedding songs for you and Cassie, but that being one of your favorite instrumental tracks and seeming like it's right out of a 1960s horror movie, I feel like that's got to be on the table for you guys. It's at least got to be in the playlist.
I mean, they're named after a 1970s murder mystery, so it does make sense.
Is that movie that recent?
Yeah, I think it's like 72, I want to say.
Yeah. I would have thought that that movie was older.
76. So would I, actually. Huh.
Yeah.
Okie doke. I'm actually just now trying to get Cassie into this band. So I am... Maybe by the time the wedding rolls around, I'll have succeeded. We'll see.
Maybe. So anyway, I don't feel strongly about it. You know, to your point about being a theater kid and appreciating it, I do like it in concert, like when that's what kind of settles the crowd in and builds to the first actual track of the set. But when I'm actually listening to an album, I'll almost always skip it upon like re-listening, like DVD menu on the new Phoebe Bridgers album. I just skip over.
Right.
It's not. It's cool. Yeah. I get why bands do it. It's just not for me in a lot of cases.
And I think it depends on how it's done and what the album is. Like there's certain records I don't need a, you know, 30-second instrumental intro.
Yeah. Like, or even, in some cases, like a 6-second horn intro.
Yeah.
Make it a part of the song.
Like even on the Fugazi song we did earlier, that album opens with a 50-second instrumental that I also skip and then goes right into the song we played before, so I'm with you.
All right, our next question, I probably should have paired with our first question, but I didn't, so forgive me. This one comes from Polyvinyl Records via Jordan. If you were a cooler, older sibling / cousin / etc. to a high schooler, what four records would you tell them to listen to? I'm a little unclear on the intent here. Are we trying to help them be cool? Are we just passing on what we think is cool? Or the really tough one to thread, are we passing on what we think they think would be cool from our music taste? So there's some ambiguity here in terms of what the purpose is. So, but I feel like that's appropriate because I feel like if I at 34 were giving a high schooler some music, I would feel very anxious about whether they would think it's cool or not. So this question does put us in the right headspace. What do you got for us, Jake?
I would definitely not do it for what they think would be cool, because there is no way I would ever know what a high schooler in 2020 would think is cool. And like, there's no way they're going to think what I think is cool either. So I think I would tackle it from the perspective of like, here are not for every genre. Like I wouldn't go like back 70 years or anything, but like, here's all the things that influence the things that you think are cool now. It's kind of how I would approach it. So I would do...
Ah, that's a good point.
I would do like Radiohead, probably. I would do TV on the Radio.
Hey, that's on my list too.
Yeah, I think it's a great point because a lot of indie rock sounds like TV on the Radio.
Also, we spent the entire TV on the Radio episode just talking about how fucking cool they are.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have done this, I think, before... Like, part of me wants to say The National, even though they're like aggressively uncool, but only because now the Destiners are behind the Taylor Swift record. Part of me is like, maybe they'll like this. And then, I don't know, I would give them like a Bikini Kill record, maybe. And then, I'd pair like Bikini Kill and the Beastie Boys is what I would do.
Okay.
Yeah, or like, good Black options. Star. I'd have to give them something in hip hop.
Yeah, Black Star is a good choice for sure. I went TV on the Radio, similar to you in terms of like a band that influenced bands that you like. I threw Rilo Kiley in there. Yep. I just think that they, and particularly Jenny Lewis, had such a big influence on a lot of, you know, singer-songwriters now.
For sure.
So TV on the Radio, Rilo Kiley. I threw Pixies in because as we've discussed for, you know, I think there were like 5 or 6 episodes in a row early on in this podcast where Pixies came up and their influence on different pop punk bands who then influenced other pop punk bands. I think it'd be cool for a younger person to, if they are into any of the current pop punk stuff or even nostalgic pop punk stuff, to trace that all the way back to Pixies. And then my final one is Slipknot. And I'm not going to explain it.
Fair enough.
I would just pass it on and leave that teen very confused.
I like it. I like it. I like it a lot.
Next question comes from Mike. He asks, after listening to the episode on Future Islands, what are your favorite B-sides from your favorite albums that were never singles? So it's a B-side. It could be on an album. I allowed myself to choose B-sides. It can be from an album. I also allowed myself to choose songs that were released from like B-side compilations.
Okay.
But so they can't have been singles even off the B-side. Like if Carly Rae Jepsen released the B-sides and Cut to the Feeling was a single, Cut to the Feeling is no longer eligible, even though it's a B-side. Yeah.
No, okay. I agree with you to an extent because I'm really, as someone who spent his high school years hunting down like when singles like as 4-track albums used to exist and those 3 other songs weren't on the albums, like those are B-sides. Songs on the album that aren't singles are not B-sides, just for the record, but I digress.
All right. Do you have some answers for us though?
I do. Yeah. There's like 100,000 Mountain Goat songs you could pick. The one that first comes to mind is I think called Steel Smoked Fish, which I believe is a B-side off All Eternal's Deck. It could be off Transcendental Youth. I'm not sure.
It's fine. It's just a podcast you had a couple days to prepare for. Sorry.
Yeah, and fucking spicy today. It's Transcendental Youth.
It's been a long day.
I was 50% right. I'll go way back to my high school days and I'll pick Wrong Side of the Tracks by The Living End. Because they are one of the bands that I would go to Sam the Record Man's CD bins and dig around for and see what I could find, because they had a lot of like, as an Australian band, they have a lot of Australia only, Japan only releases, or had before the internet made things all completely irrelevant. Been a while since I've done a big B-side dig. I guess this is technically just an EP song and not a B-side, so I'm gonna be a hypocrite even though I yelled about it 20 Whatever. Seconds ago. Senor and the Queen by the Gaslight Anthem is one of the Gaslight Anthem's best songs, and I really wish they put it out in between the Sink or Swim and the 59 Sound, and I love the 59 Sound a lot, but I really hoped that the second record was gonna sound like the Senor and the Queen EP, and so we got 59 Sound, which is amazing and one of my favorite albums. But I wish they had made one full length that sounded like that.
Yeah, that's fair. I tried to limit myself to 3. So I'm going to throw out Kill All Your Friends by My Chemical Romance, Despair in the Departure Lounge by Arctic Monkeys, and this, Cry by Carly Rae Jepsen. Now, I understand that Carly Rae Jepsen might be a little bit of a cheat for this song, just because, like, she's released two full B-side albums at this point.
But that's what B-sides are.
Yes. Our next question comes from Boofer OC, who asks, if there were a movie based on Jake and Blake's friendship, which song would be playing over the montage? If you remember a couple back, we talked about things like casting for each other and things like that. So keep those answers in mind, or go back and listen to those. So you have that image of us in mind. And what I'm assuming is a very dry, dark indie comedy.
Yeah, we're too old for it. Like, my gut instinct was like, oh, it'll be like super bad. But we're too old for it to be that like fun. It would definitely
be. No, it's like a non-romantic drinking buddies or something like that.
Yeah, or like one of the Tim and Eric like anti-comedy movies.
Yeah. Like the Duplass brothers are involved somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. Mumblecore.
Yes. I had originally thought, Jake, Go Home, Play Music, Feel Better by Michael Sarah Palin, who I announced earlier, because I feel like the Play Music, Feel Better part of that wraps up our friendship and kind of the origin story of this podcast really well. However, when I actually went back and listened to the song and the lyrics closely, and this happened a couple times with songs that I thought would maybe fit originally, it would give the impression that we are romantic together, which you're very handsome, but we are not. So I steered away from that and tried to stick to songs that can't be misconstrued lyrically.
That's fair. Did you land on one that can't be misconstrued lyrically?
Yeah, I have a couple here.
Okay. I also actually had a similar journey as you, where I started with the name, with a song title, and I was like, I don't know if this applies as much.
Yeah, did you ever watch Arrested Development?
Of course.
Yeah, so like, you know when Michael and Maybe are singing Afternoon Delight and don't realize what the lyrics are about? That's what I'm picturing us doing right now, suggesting these songs and everyone else, everyone listening to this podcast is like, wait a second.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so I my pick for that was We Are Beautiful, We Are Doomed by Los Campesinos. Because I only looked at the song title, and then I was like, wait a minute. I don't know if this works as well. So I feel like because our movie would probably involve some kind of nostalgia or trying to recreate younger days, I feel like just the chorus, like the back half of Welcome to the Black Parade would be our montage song. Because it invokes nostalgia.
That works. I do have two ska or ska adjacent options. That, you know, if you were doing the music for the movie, Fall Back Down by Rancid or Beer by Real Big Fish.
Yep.
Are both good options for that kind of thing.
I would never pick either of those in my ska, for the record. I want to make sure that's clear. But
you
don't
consider Real Big Fish ska?
Oh, I consider them ska. I just wouldn't pick them as a ska band. And I would listen to today.
Gotcha. Look, it's the closest I could get, man. You know that my ska... I'm trying to do a friendly gesture here and meet you in the ska realm. My knowledge is not as deep as yours. Please appreciate the gesture, at least.
This is the dialogue before the montage.
Yeah, this is the end of act two tension, like, drama. All right, I'll be selfish about it then. For a pessimist, I'm pretty optimistic by Paramore.
There you go. Is
a good one. And then the one that I settled on, which I know you don't like this band, and it's, you know, maybe that's a part of the story. I'm not sure. You don't like them, but you don't like them nearly as much as I do. This is Coffee Eyes by The Wonder Years.
Without you.
fitting with what I imagine the theme of the movie would be. That is a very, that's a song where Dan Campbell is going through a lot of nostalgia and like returning to his hometown and you know, yeah. We're not from the same hometown, but you could easily see both of us in that situation, I'm sure. The coming back in your mid-20s and seeing an old high school friend or whatever and going through that stuff. So that was my pick.
It fits. I like it.
It's a good track, too. Love the Wonder Years. All right. And our final question for today, this one comes from Andrew R., who asks, if you were sequencing an album, Jake, where would you place the singles?
Okay, so I have three minds on this, and I think about this a lot.
Three minds, just three.
Just three. I think depending on the song and the act, if it's like a overwhelmingly large hit that's like huge and inescapable, put it first. Or last.
Would you know that ahead of time, though?
I think it depends on who you are, which is why I'm saying it's artist dependent. Like if, like I don't think if you're, just because she's top of mind because we brought her up. If you're Taylor Swift and you have like Shake It Off, I know that's not track one on 1989, but it should be track one off 1989 because then you can just get, unless it's like a Beyonce Lemonade situation where it's part of the flow of the whole thing. I feel like if it's too big a song, you either got to put it first or last so it doesn't interrupt the flow of the rest of the album. For like a normal, quote unquote, that's the wrong term, but I'm just using it, band, I usually like it third, or I like it kind of buried and it's like seventh or eighth.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting. Jake, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Where does Joey Votto hit in the Cincinnati Reds lineup? Where does Mike Trout hit in the Los Angeles Angels lineup?
Yeah, okay. I hear you.
The answer to both is number two. That's I like the album opener to be like a tone setter that kind of, you know, if you want to consider it a leadoff hitter to extend the analogy, I like number two or number one to kind of set the tone of the album, maybe be a little quicker, a little snappier to kind of get people going. I think number two is what you as a band consider your best song. I think number four is maybe where you go with your most commercially viable song, especially if you're a band that maybe isn't, you know, a band that traditionally gets played on the radio. I think you then need to have a more single heavy top of the album to, you know, in case something, one of those two songs hits and people check you out, you want to have, you want to be a little bit top heavy to kind of capture new audience. So that's where I'd place the first two, two and four, your best hitter and your best power hitter.
Yeah, I get it. I understand the thinking behind that, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Baseball batting order theory for album sequencing. All right, Jake, we have to pick a song from today's mailbag for the mixtape. And I don't think it can be me just making noise at the beginning of the podcast. We have to choose one of the songs that we actually played and talked about. And I'm going to rule out Murder by Death because I don't want an album opening instrumental in the middle of a mixtape.
This one's tough.
Okay with you.
This is tougher than our usual mailbag ones because I feel like every song clip we have today are bands that we might do full episodes on at some point.
Oh, for sure. So and I don't think we need to govern by that necessarily because this is the B-side, so we're not going to, you know, they won't overlap too much.
I'm going to argue for Fugazi only because if slash when we do a Fugazi episode, we probably won't do that album.
All right. Cash Out by Fugazi is on the mixtape, Jake. You will hear no argument here. Carly Rae Jepsen would be too selfish a choice on my end to force in there. It also wasn't a question we spent a lot of time on.
Fair.
So, you know, maybe not reflective of the whole mailbag. And, you know, even though in spirit, Boofer's question about what would play over our montage would fit the what represents the podcast best, but we didn't have any agreement or overlap there. So cash out, it is. Jake, this is the end of our July mailbag.
What a fun day.
Yeah.
That sounded disingenuous, but I didn't mean it to.
Yeah. Jake, that's it for the mailbag, man.
Cool.
Thanks.
Please, try the fish.